Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Vulgar Burrito Podcast. I'm Dave.
I'm Mike.
Today we have special guests, former Iowa quarterback, NFL quarterback, Ricky Stanzi. We appreciate you coming on the show,
welcome.
Rick. Thanks for having me, guys. Great to be here.
And in studio, too. I might want to throw that out there because we've had some bad Zoom quality shows in the past, and this is live in studio, so it's an awesome treat to have you here. I'll throw a little backstory together real quick. Ricky, our dads grew up together. What you may not have known is they graduated with Mike's aunt.
There we go.
So they're all in the same class. Yeah. So another cool family connection is the fact that your cousin, and I consider one of my friends, Brandon Staley, was hired as the Chargers head coach over the past month. And that is just incredible for him. I'm super happy for him and his family.
It's incredible, but I'm not surprised. I thought maybe he'd be 1 year out from his head coaching job just based off of what I've seen in the NFL. But I knew he was ready.
Yeah.
Like, I knew this guy was ready to be a head coach just from knowing Brandon and the way that he controls the room and the way that he can lead. But I'm not surprised.
That's funny you say that, because I was the same. Yeah. I was like, I am totally not shocked that he's there.
Yes.
Like, it's,
I mean, you see his opening press conference. I listen to his press conferences when I get a chance. And the guy's so well-spoken. It's a very unique skill set that Brandon has, because he played the quarterback position. So starting off, he's been on the quarterback side. He knows how to lead. He knows how to lead young men. He knows how to take ownership. He has all those skill sets that you develop as a quarterback. And then he went to the other side of the ball and he coached defense from that side. And to be a quarterback coaching defense and to be as cerebral as Brandon is and to be able to articulate and lead, he's just got this beautiful blend that you look for in a head coach. And I was like, when I heard the news, I was stoked, because I think the QB at for the Chargers is the next big thing.
Justin Herbert.
He surprised me. You know, I didn't really see that coming, and he burst onto the scene.
Yep.
They've got so much talent there. They've got a great coaching staff. They got a young quarterback. It's a really cool scenario to see Brandon step into, and he's had success everywhere he goes, and you're not surprised by his success because you know Brandon as a person. I know Brandon as a person. You know how he deals with his business and his face as a leader of that franchise. I think he's going to do tremendous things.
Yeah, same here. I think he's going to be there for a long time. Mm-hmm. We're just going to ask you some questions about your career. We're going to have some fun with it and see what happens.
Yeah.
So I don't know, if Mike, if you want to go first with your...
Yeah, sure. I'll go first. I played high school football as well. I wasn't very good. You could probably fit my highlight reel into a GIF. How you ever seen?
That's fun.
So I'm as someone who played and got a... I got a letter from Hiram. Did I ever tell you that?
That's nice.
No.
Well, they spelled my name wrong, and I think so. I must not have been...
How do they spell it?
I can't remember. I had it saved for a long time, and I think at some point I threw it away. It's like, somebody's playing a joke on me. There's no way.
That's hilarious.
So I'm just curious, what was it like to be recruited by these big schools?
It was very humbling, to be honest, because I remember as an eighth grader, ninth grader, I knew I had talent, but there was also areas that I struggled. And so to get to that next level of D1, and especially when you're in it as a ninth and 10th grader, you're kind of hearing from the, you know, people that are older than you, get your education, because it's really hard to go D1. And at that same time, I was sort of struggling through sophomore year and dealing with injuries and kind of being a little down on myself. I remember telling my dad at one point, I'm like, Dad, I'm not going to play Division I football. Okay. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. I had thought that basketball was going to be my ticket because I was playing better at that sport at that time. So once I did kind of, after my junior year, I started to get healthier. I started to play better and I started to get some attention. That was when it really became surreal, and it happened fast. I mean, at the beginning, it was a lot of MAC schools. The first school that really had my attention and that offered me and that seemed serious was Akron. And I was ready to sign the paper. The second I went down there and they offered me, I was like, Dad, this is it. This is what we're doing. And he's like, relax. He's like, you've got a whole nother season to play. And so I was like super amped up, because I had just a year before been telling my dad, I don't think I'm going to play college football. Yeah. Now I got my first offer. And then at that point, it started to snowball, and I started to, put more tape together. And that's really what the coaches look for. They want a good junior season, which was fine because I had that, but I was able to back it up with a better senior year. And that was when I started to get more attention from the Big Ten teams. And that was just like, it was really mind blowing to me. I mean, at one point I'm sitting there and I'm, talking to Michigan State, I'm talking to Ohio State, I'm talking to Iowa, and I could just, at that point sense who was serious. Mm-hmm. And that was really what led me to choose Iowa. But the whole process was really humbling. It was really cool. It was fun to go through that because when you're a little kid, that's what you dream of, is playing college football. And for me, being in, you know, in Northeast Ohio, it's the Big Ten. That's every Saturday we would wake up, I'd go downstairs, mom would make breakfast, we'd turn on the Ohio State game. And so I was really wanting to play in the Big Ten. And once Iowa offered, I really had it down to Miami of Ohio and Iowa. I went and saw both schools, both wonderful campuses, great programs at the time. Big Ben had just went through there, and they kind of had, you know, the MAC was kind of pumping out quarterbacks at a pretty good clip there. But it was something about that Big Ten, something about Coach Ferentz being in Iowa, and obviously looking back, it was the right decision.
Heck yeah, man, for sure.
Originally, I was bummed because Dave got me following you too. Because he'd be like, oh, you got to see Ricky. So I was following you, and I was like, oh, I hope he goes to Ohio State. But now it's hard to, I can't imagine you in any other uniform than Iowa.
Sure. Like, it's just, it was everything worked out the way it should. And you can look back now, and it's, I remember people being like, dude, don't go to Iowa. Coach Ferentz is leaving. He's going to go to the pros. He's got all this interest, which he did. And he continued to have that the whole time we were there. But what's funny is that every other school that I was offered by had a complete wash of coaching staffs by the time that I would have probably been a sophomore, redshirt sophomore at that time. So, you know, I Ohio State was a situation where I had went and talked to them, but they had already had two guys that they had offered. So it was really a situation where it wasn't going to happen, but it was just kind of nice to at least go there, visit, have the interest. It's a unbelievable program. Obviously everybody knows how decorated it is there. It's really, looking back, it was a cool experience.
I bet now Michigan State, at least at one point, wishes they had you. And the point I'm talking about is, you probably know what I'm going to play.
Oh, I have an idea.
Stays in stands, he goes up under center. Raphael Eubanks, let's see what Michigan State does. Here's the snap. Stansy on a quick slant. Has
touchdown!
Touchdown! Marvin McNutt on the catch on the final play of the game. The Hawkeyes defeat Michigan State.
So I want to kind of get a cool perspective right now, because from your perspective, how awesome was that moment? And I'm sure people have asked you that before, and it's probably super hard to describe. Maybe it's not, but in my experience, I mean, stuff like that, I can tell you exactly where I was, what I did. I remember because this game was on late. And I remember Connor was already in bed. He was just a little baby, probably 2 or 3 years old, if I think about it. But maybe a little older, but already in bed. And I know I was having to keep it down. And I remember this happening. And I'm like, you know, when you're doing like the internal scream where you're like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got to wake somebody up and tell them. Who am I going to, you know, and I'm just like freaking out, man. But for you, what, I mean, the moment.
Yeah, it was almost a relief in a sense, because that whole game was a nightmare offensively. And I've been on a few podcasts, or we actually did like kind of we went back through this game with some Iowa fans on a Zoom a few months ago. And we were looking back at the game, and I had went across the stats, and I was like, wow, we did nothing for four quarters until really the end there at the end of the game. And we had some shots, and the game was close, and pretty much every game we played in was close, but that was a game where it just felt like we couldn't get the ball in the end zone. We couldn't get momentum, and we started to kind of build on that point, though, in the second half, and we started to move the ball to where when we got to that drive, I remember the drive before that they had where Kirk threw, a post or a seam for a touchdown, but they had hit us on a hook and ladder. And I remember sitting on the sidelines and just like almost like smiling. I'm like, wow, what a play. The stadium's going nuts.
Yeah.
And I know like, okay, they score here. We've got less than two to go down there and get it. But I don't think that we ever felt that we weren't going to score. There was something special about that team. We were a group of guys that it didn't really matter what adversity was put at our feet. We knew that we were going to overcome it. It was almost like we were expecting adversity, and we were like using that adversity to fuel us to play well. So we kept finding ourselves in these tough situations. And once we got down there to the red zone, we had three cracks at it. That was fourth down. In all three shots, they had given us this blitz zero, which essentially they're bringing everybody. You know, it's the suicide blitz from NFL Blitz video game. Like everybody's coming. They're going to man up. And so we had seen it three times, and you know, Coach O'Keefe's like, let's give him a little motion just so we can see what it looks like. And it was, sure enough, 2x2. Marvin was into the boundary. Tony was into the boundary. Moyaki. We motioned him. There it is. Blitz zero. Yeah. I'm like, dude, this is, it's over.
Yeah.
Because I got Marvin running a slant, and he's a stud.
Yep.
And actually, he had, I think, injured his thumb the week before. So Marvin really didn't even play in that game. He wasn't really supposed to play in that game, but an injury at the receiving core to Colin Sandeman kind of pushed him into that spot.
Yeah.
So we got down there, and Marvin's a big body guy. He's about 6'3". He's all 200 pounds. So when they motioned over, and it was like schoolyard ball. Oh, dude, one-on-one slant to Marvin to win the game? Like, here we go. And so it was really a relief because we were trying to keep that perfect record.
Yeah.
And we couldn't move the ball. We didn't move the ball until really when we needed to. And our defense was so stingy and outstanding the whole game and kept us in it. And we knew if we had a shot at the end, we had a chance to win any ball game we were in. I mean, the first game of that season, we had to block two kicks, two field goals at the end of the game against you and I to even be in the position that we were in. So it was a really special year, and that game was wild. And it's funny to hear people's stories because Ashley tells a story where she's like, we were at the bar, we were standing on the bar and everyone's going nuts. And, you know, you hear the stories. We went back to Iowa City and everybody was like, dude, you should have seen the downtown.
It was probably crazy.
People were running around in the streets and going nuts. So, you know, that type of stuff is it's really fun to look back on. And it means a lot to us players to see how much it means to fans, to friends, to family. Because that's what it's all about, those moments right there.
So, me and my dad got the opportunity to go to a couple of your games your senior year, your Penn State game, which was an awesome, unbelievable game.
Yep.
And then we went to Iowa for the Ohio State-Iowa game.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Penn State, we were doing pregame and actually with the Sash family, unfortunately Tyler passed away in 2015, but his family was really awesome.
Yeah.
We were all there with your family and this kid starts talking junk to your dad.
Classic. I know where this one's going.
He has no idea that it's your dad.
Oh, that's the best.
And he's all in your dad's face going, we're going to kill Stanzi. We're going to rip his head off. And I just remember my dad going, watch this.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh no, nothing happened. But your dad's like, that's my son. And magically this guy's tuned was just like, oh man, I'm just kidding, you know, like, we hope we win though.
There's a lot of tough guys in the pregame parking lot. That's what I've learned.
Yes.
I haven't seen it.
I mean,
I think last year at the Penn State game or 2 years ago, I was honorary captain. And so I got to see a little bit of the, what goes on before a game at Kinnick. But there's more than one Joe Stanzi story when it's concerning the pregame.
Oh my gosh. I'll tell you what though, much different atmosphere between college and NFL, like, because we were wearing your jersey and everybody had Iowa stuff on, and they were like literally just walking up to us going, oh man, how do you know Stan? Are you guys from Iowa? And we'd talk, and they were actually really...
Yeah,
really awesome, you know, to where if you're at an NFL game, heck, they're punching little kids and, you know, 7-year-old kids in NFL jerseys for the other team, you know, and but it was just such a much better atmosphere, I thought. But it was cool to get to see you do those, play those last few games at Iowa.
And, yep.
Especially the kind of the behind the scenes after the Ohio State game.
Those games are always like, you know, because I've always been a lifelong Buckeyes fan, but it was like, all right, if they lose, at least they're losing to Ricky. So that's cool.
Yeah. I would get that a lot. People would be like, you know, I'm rooting for you guys until you guys play Ohio State. And I was like, understandable. I wouldn't expect it any other way.
Me and my dad took the kind of stance of like, you know what? We don't owe anything to Ohio State. You know, like we know you. So it's like, we had to root you on and we could afford 1 year of not winning.
There's always those moments where you kind of are rooting for the Big Ten. You'll see that like in championship
bowl
time
games,
or bowl games
for
and,
sure.
and stuff like that. And I think that kind of speaks to what you were saying about the fans, and largely it's been a positive experience going to other campuses.
Yep.
And it's always been that way. Like we said, there's such great competition in the Big Ten and there's a lot of respect, you know, across the sidelines. And so those atmospheres are ones that are, they're incredible to be in because there's so much just emotion and every game is usually really close. And they're fun to share. And I think there is a mutual respect on both sides by the fans. And it makes it more fun. It's not fun to go to a game. And I've been to some NFL games where I've had to turn around like, what did that person just say? I'm like, wait, excuse me?
Like, really, man?
Yeah, there's some, of course, there's always going to be some brutal stuff. But
oh, yeah.
It's really however you want to look at it at that point.
After the Ohio State game, you were kind of doing your final tour through the city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it was your final game tour, because that was your last game at home. And I remember getting to ride with you in the car through that and everything. And so I felt like I was like living vicariously through. I know this guy, everybody. I know this guy. But there was a bunch of people in your car. There was only one spot left, and I ended up having to stand in the middle where normally there's an armrest, but it kind of got pushed back. And I remember sitting in between, I think it was maybe you and AJ Eads.
Yeah.
And I just remember making eye contact with Eads, and I was like, this is my moment. He laughed so hard. He's like, this is what you've trained for.
Yes.
And I'm like, it is, really. Like, who else would have fit in this spot? But
this is it.
Yeah, that was a fun night, man. That was cool to see, like, you go into bars, like, there was, you know, cakes made for you. Like, you just, it's so amazing to see how much back that a city can put behind their quarterback. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And it's so cool that you got to, you know, experience that. And
Iowa City is a special place. Iowa fans are definitely a special group because, I mean, they are all over the world. Everywhere I've went, I've run into Iowa people that are, you know, they have a backstory of where they were in Iowa at some point, whether it was from a childhood or maybe a job took them there. But there's something special about Iowa City and Kinnick and that little downtown area. And I think that on the outside, especially when I was getting recruited, I remember being like, Iowa? They'd be like, dude, it's just cornfields. There's nothing there. But when you go there and you see Iowa City, like, oh, this is a pretty cool town. This is the prototypical college town.
Yeah.
It's got your stadium. You take one cab down to the city and you got all the bars within walking around distance.
Yeah.
And everybody's really, they grow up Hawk fans. You know, there's no pro team there. And so it's really the state sort of divided between Iowa State and Iowa. And I think Iowa's had the upper hand because of just being a Big Ten school and, you know, having a history and a storied past. But you really get to feel that love when you go there and you become, you know, a player on a team that wins and that never leaves. And we still see it to this day, me and my buddies and the fans are so appreciative of the product that is Iowa football. And you know, Coach Ferentz, he never let us sleep on that. You know, he would say, he goes, these people, they work hard. They pay good money to come watch you. You think they're going to sit through y'all putting out mediocre effort. They're not.
Right.
Like, and so we always had that, like, you have to give back to the fans. You have to give great effort because it's really everybody's involved in it, you know? And I mean, we would be crazy to think that our fans at Kinnick didn't help us win games. I mean, you were there. They're on top of you. Right. So it's a tough atmosphere to play in. You know, that 12th man, they as they call it, the fan is a real thing. And Iowa is special because of the no pro team and just how they kind of they embrace the players and it never leaves. And once you're a Hawk, you're always a Hawk.
And it's funny when you say that there's Hawkeye fans everywhere, because I went on a business trip in 2013, I believe it was, and went out to L.A. I was just I didn't know anybody. I was going to be there for 3 or 4 days. And I was just like, hey, you know, pull up my match.com account and see. And it switched it to, you know, women in LA. And here's a girl in a Ricky Stanzi jersey. And I'm like, what in the heck? What? So I, you know, message her and I'm like, you're not going to believe this. I'm friends with Ricky.
Yeah. There you go. And,
and I'm like, think about it. If How Ricky like only knew.
Sign?
I did. I said, we were, you know, I told her I knew. She messaged back. We ended up going out that night and just having a great time. And, I remember saying, can you get me a picture? That's why I brought it over to your house. Yeah. I'm like, can you sign this for Jen? You know, I'm still friends with her to this day. Very cool that it was just like, it's funny you bring that up. Like, they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
I have a clip here everybody seems to love. And I just, we'll get a little explanation in a minute, but let's listen to the clip here.
I know you're from Middle America. You feel like sometimes you're representing more than just a school or a conference, maybe an entire group of American citizens out there.
Well, of course. I mean, there's nothing better than being American. So, I mean, this is the greatest feeling. If you don't love it, leave it. USA, number one.
There it is. My question, where did that, was that just spur of the moment or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, a little bit of everything. We were, me and my roommates, we were watching a lot of Ricky Bobby at the time. And so we would just be firing quotes back and forth and kind of talking in that same type of Ricky Bobby way, if you will. And when I think it's Chris Myers, when Chris Myers asked that question, I kind of really wasn't sure where to go with it.
Yeah.
And so once again, default on a little bit of comedy and just kind of, you know, go with like something that's a little going to get people rowdy and fire them up. And so we had been, I think there's a Merle Haggard song and I'm forgetting the name for whatever reason, but he drops that line in there. If you don't love it, leave it. And so we would, that song was just in my head and we would say that saying quite a bit. And then it just happened organically at that point. And it was like, it got a rise from my roommates, which is really what I was looking for. Cause if you watch the video, I turn around immediately and I point to them like, can you believe I just said that on national television? And I heard some funny stories. You know, Brian Ferentz, Coach Ferentz's son, he was with the Patriots at the time. He's like, so we're in the office late and we're watching your game and we're listening. And he goes, and I hear this quote and he goes, and I lean back and I go, what did he just say? And he was like talking to another coach. But I mean, I had way more positive than I did negative from that. But there was still like, I was amazed at how much there was people wanted to say something about what I had said. And still to this day,
dude,
now, I mean, most of the podcast, they'll bring up that moment. And it was really just a fun loving situation. You know, I mean, we had been lost a couple games at the end of the season. I had been injured. I didn't know if I was going to play in the bowl game. I was healthy enough to play in the bowl game. We all had a great game. Everybody was feeling good. And I was just like,
you just threw it out there.
Jubilant. Yeah. Like you're literally sitting up there, you know, after a BCS game and you're on the stage and you're like, this is super surreal.
Yeah.
And you know, like I said, I'm kind of a goofball. I always kind of err on the side of comedy and getting a rise out of the teammates and the roommates. So that was pretty much where it originated from, but it's been good fun since then.
And it blew up during that time. Cause I mean, t-shirts were made.
Oh, yeah.
My dad, we would text back and forth all day. And I know he was texting with your dad. The memes that were generated where people would Photoshop your head on like American thing. Oh my God. Yeah. Rambo firing the gun, but it's your face. And there were just so many. And we'd like, did you see the new one? Did you see the new one? We'd text it back and forth. But yeah, we had shirts. I know I had a couple of shirts, American.
My mom brought them over the house the other day. She's like, do you want these? I'm like, Mom, I am not going to wear the shirt that says Americanzy and has my funny face on the front. But there's actually a funny story about that YouTube video because that thing's still out there. It's the one with all, there's a memes, the memes are
where
rolling.
They're going through.
They're going through and it's playing the Hulk Hogan entrance music from it. So this is 2015. I'm in camp with the Giants and Eli Manning had somehow got wind of this quote in this video on YouTube. So he goes up there and he's pretending to have like a meeting where he's going to address us. And he gets up and he like starts this like opening like dialogue. And he's like, we're going to watch a video here. And I think you guys will understand it after this video. And I'm like, what are we going to do? And the music hits and my freaking YouTube video comes up. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding.
Oh my God.
So like everybody's in the room sitting there watching this silly video as I'm just sitting there and they're like, did you make that? I was like, no, I didn't make that. You guys think I spent the time to make these memes of myself? I'm like, that's some great Iowa fans. Somewhere, but it's, you know, even in 2015, I never knew when that was going to be like, someone's going to find this out and they're going to play it in front of the team. And sure enough,
man, I don't think a lot of people knew, but like you didn't do social media.
Didn't do it at all.
Yeah.
Until I left.
I really, looking back, I think that's like one of the best decisions you ever made just
absolutely.
Because
for sure.
I would read some of the comments and stuff and it's like, you read now and it's like, you don't know the person. So it's like, no big deal.
Right.
But when you know the person and people are on there firing away, you feel the need to like get into it with them. And I'm like, now I can see why you don't like, it could just be this downward spiral of like,
That was something that I decided during college. Like, I remember somebody was like, oh, you have a Facebook. I'm like, all right. Okay. So I'm like, what am I doing? I'm like, what, it just didn't serve me at that point, you know? And then it was nice because I didn't have any presence online until I was done and I was transitioning into a second career. And that was when I started to actually use social media up until now. So I never got burnt out on the social media. I never got into any of those spats with anybody. And it was good that I didn't because at that point when it was starting to kind of climb, I was struggling in the NFL. I wasn't starting. I wasn't playing well when I did get in. So like there's those things that you're kind of dealing with and you hear what the media has to say about you some way, shape, or form. But if you as a player can diminish it, by all means, you probably should.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just one less thing that you have to think. And we see what happens to players when the meet. You know, you guys see it here.
You say especially one wrong Cleveland. Thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's tough. And so I think that, and it's almost kind of impossible nowadays. It's kind of cat out of the bag. I mean, every athlete for the most part has a social media presence, and a lot of them do a tremendous job with it. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's not easy as an athlete. I'm not sure how they do it with that comment section.
Yeah, and they got to tiptoe on everything they say.
Create a burner account like Kevin Durant.
Because then that happens. Yeah. It's like, oh man, what a nightmare that is. You know, yep. Trying to wrestle that thing back in with a PR, and it's just like,
it's just,
it seems like it's when you're on Twitter, when you're on social media, so much is up for interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned this even with Goda, where I'll throw a post out there. I'll be like, oh, this is the one. And I'll like, people be like, that one confused me. I'm like, dang dude. Like, I thought that was it. Like, I thought y'all were going to get that one. So it's a lot of that. And I think, you know, the people get the meanings and misinterpreted all the time, where somebody runs with what they think that athlete meant. And then it's just, things happen so fast nowadays with social media that it's really tough for the athlete. And they have to do a tremendous job of navigating. I always use Tom Brady as the kind of the model of how you should behave as an NFL player. Yeah. And Coach Ferentz was like adamant about like just giving them the Bill Belichick responses, where it's just like very cold, very calculated, not giving them too much. And so I came from that world. So navigating the media wasn't a problem. I was just like really trying to deal with the fans and stuff. It's just better to not have it.
It's funny. We're all out here fighting your battles.
Yes. I would hear about them. I'd be like my dad, but I'm like, I can't get into it, guys. I'm going to stay over here.
Like, you can't win either way.
If I say something, then it's just as bad as if me, of even having the Twitter or the social media to start with.
Oh, don't worry. We handled everything.
You guys handled it. I'm sure we handled it all.
But,
when did the NFL start to become a possibility for you, and was getting drafted ever in the back of your mind when you were playing?
It was kind of a lot like the high school story and going to college. You know, I felt like I got so consumed with just trying to play well. Like that was my first focus. Like, okay, let's just get on the field in high school, Rick, before we think about D1. And then it happened so fast. And sort of the same thing with Iowa. I remember, to this day, the conversation, me and my dad, I was in the bubble walking around, and my dad's like, what do you think about transferring? Because I was at that point at Iowa where I was like, I got a couple guys in front of me. They got more talent than I do. Am I going to see the field ever? Because it's a real possibility just to sit the sideline your whole career. And so at that point, it was a similar situation to a high school where it really just happened fast. You know, before I knew it, I was getting a chance to compete in my third year. I had some success, and that kind of vaulted me into the position where Coach Ferentz was like, we don't want to do this back and forth quarterback thing. You're going to be our starter. And so at that point, it was I was in my third year and I had redshirted. So I was kind of a sophomore at that point. And that was where I was like, whoa, like I'm here. I'm in the Big Ten. I'm a starting quarterback. Mm-hmm. Like, and so my focus was just being the best quarterback that I could be. And I had a decent, sophomore campaign. It was, I did the best that I probably could at that point. And then the next year I came back and I felt more confident, felt like more of a gunslinger. But that year I really was playing gunslinger. I was throwing it around a bunch and I had, 15 touchdowns, like 13 picks. So I was throwing a lot of interceptions. I wasn't being smart with the ball. I was kind of testing my strength. And then my senior year it was really focused on like, okay, I got to play efficient football. And at that point when I started to play more and more efficient football and I had improved so much from the past season, that was kind of in the natural progression of, hey, coaches are starting or, you just hear little grumblings. Mm-hmm. You really don't know. And I honestly feel for the athletes right now that are going through this draft process. It's such a weird process in general. It's a really interesting process. But to have it during the COVID is really tough for them because they don't have the same amount of exposure that we did. But it happens fast. It's like the senior year's over and it's like the day after. It felt like it's like, okay, let's start the combine prep because it really happens that fast. So it just, before you know it, the senior season's over. I was playing well during my senior year. We weren't having as much team success as we did in 09 because we were losing those close games that we talk about. Yeah. We were kind of on the other side of those. And then in the last four games of the season, we struggled and we were able to, finish out with a victory. But I was so consumed and so focused on sort of one week at a time that it was really just take it step by step. And then once I got into the draft process, then it became surreal. And really at that point though, there's so much information, you have no idea where you're going to go. You know, you hear different rounds and you're just kind of like, at some point, I remember just being like, Rick, just stop worrying. Like, there's nothing to even do right now besides just sit here and wait. There's so much noise and circulation, and you're trying to, you really have a job interview daily. You know, you get a call from a team and you sit there for an hour and talk to them. You don't know when that's coming, or they'd want to come visit you at campus. So you'd be at Iowa. So it just felt like a 2 month, 3 month job interview that was stressful. But those things are great to be put in those pressure situations with a little bit of adversity, and you kind of got to think on your feet. I think that there's something to learn in all those situations. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed all those processes of going from a high school player to a college player and then going from college to pro. They're slightly stressful, but you learn a lot.
When you got drafted and you got into camp, I know they put rookies through an initiation.
Mm-hmm.
What was your initiation? What did you have to do?
So we had to, when we got there, we had to, everybody had to get up at some point before, like, we'd have like a nighttime team meeting, and we'd have to, every night they'd be like, all right, rookie, somebody get up there. And you'd have to go up there. You'd have to state your name. What round were you drafted? What was your signing bonus? And then you have to sing a song. And so, like, you're out there like, oh, dude, like, what song am I going to sing? Like, you needed to think. Yeah. You needed to have something ready. It's sure. Basically, like, I was in the room with, like, with Matt Castle, and Matt's like, dude, get a song ready. Like, have something. So, because if guys would go up there and they'd be just like, and they would get booed. It was dude, you were getting booed. You were getting kicked out. So I was like, all right, I'm going to sing the song from Hangover, Stu's song, when he sings about the tiger. And so I'm like, I'm gonna go comedy, because if I try to take myself serious, I'm gonna be a funny guy. I'm gonna do Stu's song. And so I sang that song, and it got everybody clapped. Liked it. But that was just the beginning of it. So then at the end of camp, you gotta do a rookie show. So a rookie show is like basically all of us rookies get together and we kind of film some skits. We're making fun of each other. We're making fun of our teammates, making fun of coaches, just whatever situations are presenting themselves for those weeks that you're sitting there at camp. And we had a great video guy who was all on board. And luckily for us, the year before, those rookies, they were terrible. So the expectations were like super low. So we were able to kind of step in, and what we did was, the video guy helped us film a bunch of skits of just like funny things that kept popping up, you know, that would just become inside jokes for the team. And then I was hosting it, but I hosted it as our strength coach. And then we had an assistant strength coach that was like total, like kind of like meathead, like straight in line, like no sugar. And we had another guy be the co-host, but he pretended to be a robot the whole time. So we were just like, we were doing like funny, like voice drops. And like, we really had a lot of fun with it, to be honest. That's awesome. One of those things that was like, okay, we got to give these veterans something.
Yeah.
And, but at the same time, you know, we can't, totally embarrass ourselves.
Right. Right.
But there's gotta be a little bit of both. And so that was really the initiation, was, you know, singing, and then having to do a rookie show. And then what was even funnier was when I went to the CFL for a cup of coffee, a year and a half, I'm 30 years old, but I'm a rookie. So I got to get up there and I got to sing again? And I did it again. But you get a lot of respect when you're a 30-year-old rookie and you embrace it.
Yeah.
Because we would have like rookies like, I'm not doing that. I'm like, bro, you need to get up there and do that. Like, you need to go up there and sing. And so I went up there and sang. And then, of course, that led into, I needed to host that rookie show. So I hosted the rookie show in the CFL. I played Leslie Chow. For whatever reason, the Hangover's just the only talent that I have is to make fun of people from the Hangover. So I hosted as Leslie Chow as my rookie year. The guys in the CFL loved it so much that I hosted my second year again, as a rookie. Just, they're like, you got to bring Leslie Chow back.
That's awesome.
And so I brought Leslie Chow back for that show. And it was fun. I mean, you have a good time with that kind of stuff, and it's great memories. I'll get a text from a buddy every now and again from either team, like, do you remember that rookie show? You know, like, it's good. Those are really the moments in sports that I remember the most, is like being with your buddies, the camaraderie of it.
Yeah.
Like, that little stuff is like really what hits home, and that's what builds those lifelong friendships.
Yeah. And that's what's fun as fans too, and people listening, is, you know, we don't get to see that behind the scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's cool that we get to hear that from you. One thing kind of interests me now, there's a photo online anybody can find if you just pull up Tom Brady, Ricky Stanzi. And there's a picture of you at midfield with Tom Brady, and he's telling you something.
Yep.
Curious minds want to know.
Yeah.
Mainly me. What was he telling you?
Well, there's a backstory to that. So when I was coming out of college and I was getting ready to go to the draft process, Tom Brady's throwing coach, or his throwing mentor really since he was 12 years old, was Tom Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, dude, I want to work with Tom Martinez, you know? And there's a little bit of, at that point in my career, I was struggling with my mechanics near the end of my senior year. I kind of started to develop the yips. I was like, I need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And so that was a tough period for me from a movement standpoint, which really what kind of was a catalyst that led to what I do today. But I was working with Tom Martinez. And so I got to know Tom really well. He's since passed on, but what a great coach and just a great mind to pick his brain about the quarterback position. But, you know, he was obviously very close with Tom Brady.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was a connection there, and Tom and I had, you know, talked real quickly after the game, and he was basically like, listen to Tom Martinez, you know, do what he says kind of thing. But it was, I mean, there's nothing more surreal than to meet, because he was my hero from when I was growing up as a quarterback. Yeah. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, skinny, lanky dude that can, I identify with that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so I'm like, Tom Brady was always a huge fan.
Yeah.
To finally meet him and you know, shake his hand and see him play live on the side. I mean, it was crazy. It was really cool.
And to work with his quarterback coach. Yep. And I know you were on I don't know if it was an ESPN 30 for 30 with Tom Martinez, where it was basically the process of mm-hmm. Tom Martinez working with these quarterbacks, because I believe he worked with not only Tom Brady, but was it Steve Young or Joe Montana?
Yeah,
I think it was.
He had a really good history of guys, and he had a lot of video that, and I remember that. Like, I remember just pouring over the video, and he had all this cool video that was really behind the scenes of Tom Brady throwing, Tom Brady working out. He had old John Elway clips too.
Wow.
So he had all this great video that I was able to pour over as a young kid and trying to understand the throwing motion better. And, you know, for me at the time, I was never able to get it. I was never able to I know why he picked, or why Tom Brady looks the way that he looks and moves the way that he moves, and John Elway moves the way that they move, because they move like GOTAs, which is what led to what I do today. So like, even back then, like looking at all that stuff, it wasn't for nothing. You know, it's like you look back and you're like, you're going through something, you're struggling with your own skill set. But I always remember that during those times, I was like, I don't know what I'm learning here, but I'm learning something.
Yeah.
And at some point, it'll make sense.
Yeah.
And I just kind of got to just ride this thing out and just deal with the inconsistencies that I'm going through physically. And once again, another moment where the adversity kind of helps you get another layer of that armadillo skin.
Yeah.
You just get a little bit tougher mentally. And you figure out like what, that was when I kind of learned like, okay, these are my problems that I need to figure out.
Right.
These are the things that bother me every single day. How does the body move efficiently? Like, it wouldn't leave me alone. And so that question just kept snowballing and evolving into basically my passion that essentially became my second career. So even those struggles back in 2010, 2011, I'm so grateful for them.
Yeah.
Because without them, I don't find what it is that bothers me, what it is that makes me, you know, what gets me going every single morning when I wake up, what's the questions I need to answer. That was, back in 2010 that started, probably even before that, subliminally.
I forget where I had read it, but you had a history of throwing your back out?
Yep. You know, and as I've kind of gone on, you know, podcasts lately, and I'm talking more about GOTA, I kind of am really just telling my own story from a physical standpoint, you know, mm-hmm. from a what did I deal with that I was trying to figure out for so long. And really since ninth grade, I would have these just throw my back out, back spasms. And it was always attributed to, well, you're growing. You know, I grew like 6 to 8 inches in like 1 year. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like a bonsai tree. I'm like growing in a desk at school wearing Doc Martens.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you have all the wrong things posturally in your life as you're trying to grow. Not to mention I'm training poorly at the time. And it just kind of all compounded to where I would continually have back problems. And I didn't figure that out until I met Coach Gill and I started working with GOTA, that I really understood, this is why I'm struggling with this, and this is why it's not getting fixed any other way. And that was when I found out that Gilly's using slow motion to really reverse engineer what's right. And I was like, well, where have I seen this before? Every football facility I've ever gone to mm-hmm. is just literally slow motion video. It's just see, feel. We're going to look at what works. We're going to observe the best behaviors, the best practices, and we're going to emulate those things. And that was really what Tom Martinez was doing when he was looking at John Elway and trying to reverse engineer. What's the magic here?
Right.
Because ain't nobody throwing the ball like this guy's throwing it. What's he doing? Oh, well, Tom Brady does that. Aaron Rodgers does that. These other guys are doing Drew Brees. There's a similar behavior that's playing out. Really, the magic's down at the foot and ankle. And if you look at that foot and ankle and how it's playing out, my eyes were always on the ball. I was always looking at where the ball tracked from where they were holding at their chest. My intention was above the belt. And once I met Gilly, he brought the eyes down below the belt to the hip and the ankle gyroscopes and how they were playing through space. And at the same time, it was really a perfect storm for me with the certain books that I was reading, and I was diving into the Eastern arts, and I was taking a more sort of holistic approach, you know, 40,000 foot view, as I like to say it, where I was like, okay, let's just back up here. Let's pan out and let's look at everything. Mm-hmm. Not just weightlifting, not just this, let's get a bigger view. And that was when the idea of studying nature became an underpinning that I was like, well, we're not doing that in the West. But a lot of these Eastern arts are concerned with what is happening in nature. And that I started to gravitate towards that more so. And at that same time, I met Gilly. And Gilly was all about studying the indigenous, studying the crawling baby. He was looking at those closest to the source, those closest to nature. How do they behave? How do they move? Oh, it just so happens their foot and ankle complex looks a lot like John Elway's and Tom Brady's. Yeah. And there's this similar pattern that's going on. And then I watched myself move in slow motion. And the 10 years of questioning and not knowing immediately all made sense like that. I was like, wow. Okay,
yeah.
Well, now I know why my back is spasming out. Your right ankle is in the grave, like your inside ankle bone low. You're not moving the way that Tom Brady moves. You're not moving the way John Elway moves. In fact, you're moving like the injured people move. So until I change that, I'm always going to have these issues. Yeah. So that decade long sort of try to figure it out since 2010 all made sense once I met Gilly, but all that work from 2010 till then was what made it snap like that.
Yeah.
And made it like, oh, this is easy. We're going to watch tape.
Yeah.
I've been doing that since seventh grade.
Yeah. You mm-hmm. got visual yep. of everything. Yeah. We talked, you know, cause as we get older, you know, things start to hurt a lot more. Yeah. His wife has some back issues, and I went to the emergency room for my back. I was doing a squat, and it's funny. Well, it wasn't funny at the time, but
funny at the time.
You know, once the pain's through, and I remember talking to Mary about this, and I said, you know, I'm sure you're the first person that popped in my head, because I'm like, I bet you it was something I did as far as movement in my squat
mm-hmm.
that caused my back to angle the, you know, the way it did, and for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've talked about
your wife. Yeah, my wife she's been working on her posture
because mm-hmm.
She was having back pain. She has scoliosis.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been working on her posture and she's been doing exercises. And it's, the moment she started working on it, the back pain went away.
Mm-hmm.
And then Monday at work, I don't know if I stepped wrong, but mm-hmm. I got a shooting pain in the middle of my back. And now, like, if I lay on my side and try to get up, it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I did something. Like, I almost slipped on ice last week. And I wonder if I did something and I just ended up moving wrong a few days later. And that's what...
Right.
And it's just amazing that little movements like that...
is all it takes.
Yeah, that's all it takes. And I know, because we kind of want to segue into what you do now. And I see your posts all the time. I know Mike does too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll watch the videos. And, mm-hmm. you know, I try to absorb what you're saying. And sometimes it is on a higher level than I watch it a few times. And I'm like, I'm kind of understanding. But as for someone who's never seen mm-hmm. A single post of yours or anything like that... how would you explain what you do now, how long you've been doing this, and maybe some of the people you work? I know you worked with Odell Beckham mm-hmm. at one point mm-hmm. During his, what was a hip injury.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically what we're saying, when I dropped the word already, GOTA, but GOTA and WOTA is what you'd see if you went to our page. And GOTA is the company name, but what GOTA stands for is greatest of all time actions. So the greatest of all time actions by the greatest of all time athletes. And the four super tribes that were studied in slow motion were the crawling baby, the indigenous or the hunter-gatherer, the super freak decade plus athlete that rarely gets injured, your Randy Moss, your Michael Jordan, your Simone Biles, your Ed Reed, John Elway, we can keep listing them. And then the last would be your 70 plus age grouper at the marathons and in the track and field world championship. So by studying those four groups in slow motion, Gilly was seeing a pattern play out, right? And it was really tying back to this crawling, this innate crawl that there's documentation of babies coming right out of the womb, then putting them in water where they can adjust for gravity. And they're seeing this reflex, this obviously deeply innate pattern of what we call the bow in the corner, just this pressure wave, just building energy on one side of the body and then releasing that energy and then catching it over on the other side. It's the forward movement cycle. It's walking. It's moving from A to B. There is a simple underpinning to what we do or what we're designed to do as humans, and that's go forth. Walk, run, throw, swing, strike is really what these bodies are developed to do. That's what the indigenous do. That's what, when this body's put in nature, that's your skill set. You've got the endurance to go for a long period, and your skill set is moving forward through space. Your skill set is swinging and throwing. Look at the athletes that are paid the most money. It's those that can swing a bat, that can swing a club, or they can throw something. Because those are the skill sets that we are developed into. It's what we are designed to do. So at GOTA, what we were looking at was, how does the body move through space for a lifetime and never get hurt for no apparent reason? Why are we having back issues that are unexplained? We don't even know why. How does this happen? In conjunction with Gilly looking at the four super tribes, the other thing he was looking at was, okay, well, how does it fall apart? So he started to look at the ACL shred, the non-contact ACL shred. You put your foot in the ground and the ACL shreds. Or the non-contact Achilles shred. You put your foot in the ground, the Achilles shred. What's the common denominator there? What he found was the common denominator of that is the exact opposite of GOTA. So we call that WOTA, worst of all time actions. And it's literally using the wrong side of your foot. To give you a simple description of it, your foot is a pivot point. It's an anchor. It's going to anchor down, and you really have a default side of your foot that you're supposed to anchor to, the outside edge. So essentially from your second toe all the way around that outside corner to a bone called the cuboid right before your heel, that's sort of your pivot point or your platform, your blade, your outside blade as we call it, that becomes the arch of the foot. We know that arches aren't supposed to collapse. It's obvious that they're supposed to stay intact. You can think of your feet as half dome arches. Mm-hmm. And so the half dome is sloping to the outside edge. The inside of that half dome is a cliff side. That'd be your big toe side. You don't want to put pressure into the big toe because what you've essentially done is collapse the arch. So you need to keep your arch intact on landing and on leaving. Like, obvious, it should just never collapse. It's an arch. So that arch needs to stay intact as you put your foot in the ground. That ankle gyroscope is basically a restricted ball and socket joint, meaning it's got to turn out to set energy, and then it's got to turn in to release it. But it needs an arch intact to do this correctly. Now, if you go to the inside edge and you collapse that arch, your ankle gyroscope has to go in with it. And that is what's shredding people's Achilles and ACLs, is that they're using the inside of their foot as the anchor, and they have basically disorganized foot and ankle complexes that are trying to travel forward through space using the lifting engine. And so this is where it comes into, well, are we doing this to ourselves? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Between the Western society and the poor footwear that we've been designing, the chairs, which is a poor resting model because we're supposed to rest on the floor, and then the training is the opposite of what we were designed. If we go back to what were we designed to do, what we say, walk, run, throw, swing, strike, go forward, go forward. Well, there's a reverse gear to this. That's called lifting. So let's picture yourself walking, walking, walking. Oh, you see something you want to pick up. You stop, you put your hands on that, and you essentially take those gyroscopes that are built to go forward, and you just spin them in reverse. And when you spin them in reverse, you kick into a reverse gear to pick up that object. What we've done wrong is we've created a training industry that is built off of the lifting blueprint. So everything's a lifting derivative. So what you're doing is you're constantly lifting, lifting, lifting. And you're also in a world where you wear shoes that disengage your foot from the ground. You sit in chairs that disengage your hip and back from what they should be doing on the ground. And then you go in and you just lift, lift, lift. You're re-educating the foot and ankle complex to do what we said not to do, to use the inside of the foot as the anchor, to set the energy in and then wash it out. You should be inside ankle bone high with a high arch, and you should set that bow, like we call it, when you turn out, and then you turn the shin bone in. Well, when you've got a shoe that's doing the support for you, right. When mm-hmm. you've got a chair yeah. that's holding you up, and then you go into a weight room and you're constantly creating torque off the inside of the foot because you're doing kettlebell swings, you're doing back squats, you're doing heavy deadlifts, you're doing all this lifting derivative, you're recoding, or you're decoding, as we would call it, and you're rewriting the default iOS. You're changing the iOS. You're changing the way that your nervous system wants to play that foot off the ground, because the nervous system is malleable to the environment. It's a servant to the environment. It's mm-hmm. got to do what we tell it to do. So if I stuff my body into a chair for 4 or 5 decades, you're going to stand up and kind of look like a chair, which we've seen. Everybody's yeah. heads are forward. Everybody's got the shoulders mm-hmm. that are cloaked. Ankle bones are low. We've essentially, it's like Chinese foot binding. To give you, that's an extrapolated version of what the nervous system is capable of when it's forced into certain corners. The same thing happens when you force your foot into a shoe, or you force your body into a chair, or you force yourself into an Olympic lifting routine or a kettlebell swing routine or a back squat routine that's constantly calling on this reverse mechanism. So back to the beginning, the slow motion video allows us to now diagnose a human body moving through space. And I can say, hey, Dave, your right ankle, it's not behaving correctly. This is probably why your right back side, the side of your body, is falling apart on you. Mm-hmm. Because it comes down to your behavior at your foot and ankle looks more like the WOTAs than it does the GOTAs. And so what we do is we're going to recode you. We're going to just like that information changed. It can change back. But we've got to kind of go through a certain process to almost, if you would, wine and dine the nervous system to get it back to its innate way. Now, the older you get, the more troublesome this becomes. Once you get over 30, we all know that it takes a lot of intention and a lot of discipline to make change. So you're best to keep your GOTA when you're a baby and just never lose it.
Yeah.
And then you'll be fine. You lock it in through the adolescence. When you don't lock it in and you start to move WOTA, which is what I was doing, you get to like 25, 26, 27, about that 30, things start to fall apart. And then once you're 50 or 60, it's what? A new joint, a new replacement.
Is this all, it's pretty new, right? I mean, maybe a few years of really starting to get the information out there.
Yeah, I'd say about 4 or 5 years of really getting out there. But Gilly's been doing this since, you know, 2010.
Yeah.
It's really been a 10-year process.
So the more people that are finding out about it, I mean, how long is there a time on the whole process? Like, you can't just say like somebody's going to get this
right
within a month. I mean, are we talking like years to reprogram the body to move correctly?
And that depends on where you're at. Like an example I always use is my dad. And my dad is somebody who he moved incorrectly and his knees have taken the pounding. And so where he is and what he needs will take him much longer than, let's say, a 15, 16-year-old kid that's starting to show and move the way that my father and his friends moved, but he's only 15 or 16. We could clean that up in 3 months, give it if I get the, you know, the right commitment to the recode. And that's where this, it becomes a game of reps. It's just inputs, right? Yeah. It's just inputs. It's time under tension. That can be, that's where the wine and dine sort of happens. Like, I've got to be smart about this person in front of me and what their previous injuries were, how old they are, how much can their nervous system handle? How much volume can they handle? So it's going to depend on what that assessment shows. So we're basing it off of the assessment. I want to see you move in slow motion. I want to see what your suppleness looks like. I want to see what you're capable of. And then from there, I'm going to decide. Now, a lot of what I do, I'm more of, I would consider myself a movement guide, a lifestyle guide, if you will, a corrective guide, where I want you to understand how to walk. I want you to understand how to walk well throughout your day. I want you to understand how you should rest throughout your day. I want to go about building you a better resting sort of, you know, environment at home. In places that you can get to the ground, let's do that. Because that's going to help remold and reshape the body back to its innate design. So I do a lot of that. And then I will assign people corrective exercises based off that assessment. And then we've also, you know, we have a full system at play. So we have the base of your pyramid is really groundwork and sustaining support work. But as you travel up, this thing scales right into the weight room.
Yeah.
And so we've now found a way to, okay, this is what we got to walk away from in the weight room. Here's what we can do. And let's do this, this, and this instead of this and that, right? Instead of the heavy back squats and the deadlifts, we're going to do the landmine and the henny and the sled, because that's going to allow us to keep the inner ankle bone high. Yep. We're not lifting weight. We're moving weight now. So we can stay in this default pattern, because sports is forward gear. The only sports that are using the lifting engine are the lifting sports. Olympic lifting and powerlifting. That's when they're actually lifting weight. The only time a football player or basketball player uses the lifting engine is after the play when they pick their buddy up off the ground. Otherwise, it's drive engine versus drive engine. O-line versus D-line, drive versus drive. Running back versus linebacker, drive versus drive. Cornerback versus wide receiver, drive. It's just a game of locomotion out there. So we're taking these thoroughbreds and we're programming their nervous systems incorrectly. We're giving them the wrong inputs. They should be dialing in their locomotion, because that's all that's used on the court, the pitch, or the field. And so we've got to get their nervous systems back to the default pattern, or you're going to see what you saw this past season.
Yeah.
Just a bloodbath of Achilles and ACLs. And it hit home in Cleveland. We got a lot of guys that are inside ankle bone in Cleveland.
For sure.
And you know, you hate seeing like a Grant Delpit. Star guy, he's inside ankle bone low. We knew it was coming. He's an LSU guy. Can predict that a mile away. Know how to fix it. Like, and those are the things that we're trying to, and we're getting pushback, because we're ruffling some feathers, obviously.
Yeah.
Because we're going out there saying, yeah, we're not doing any of this lifting stuff anymore. Well, you know how deeply entrenched.
Right.
Those talents have
done it their whole life.
And yeah, they've done it their whole life.
Right. Let's say, you know, Connor, my son, he's in lacrosse, and, you know, obviously I want the best for him and make sure he's doing everything correctly. But where does a person start? Like, what are kids finding out about this and their parents are signing them up, and where do they do that? And
it kind of depends, you know. A lot of younger kids are on Instagram. Some parents aren't. We have a Facebook presence. We have an Instagram presence. We have a YouTube presence. We have a Twitter. We have a presence out there. I would tell people the first place to go would be go to movement.com. G-O-A-T-A movement.com. That'll give you like a little synopsis of what it is that we're talking about. And then I would go to gotocoaches.com. And gotocoaches.com is going to show you, is there a coach in my area, right? And if not, well, luckily nowadays we're getting pretty good at working online. Everybody is.
Oh, yeah,
so we're doing the same thing at GOTA. And you know, we've got an app and we've got a website where people can now train online. We can, you know, get you with a coach, have them work with you on FaceTime or whatever it may be to help you understand really what I want each person to understand is, where are you currently? Because that's what's most important right now is, where are you currently? And then give them an idea of where you want them to go. Mm-hmm. Right. Here's where you are. You're a WOTA. We got to get you to GOTA, because if not, here's what can happen. And in the process of that, I'm trying to give them the knowledge and the understanding of the 90%, as we would call it, the day to day, how you walk in the grocery store, how you pick up that piece of paper or that bucket, right? How you sit when you watch TV. That's the stuff that I'm interested in, because that's really where the breakdown or the level up can really hurt us or help us.
Yeah.
You know, you can get a lot of work done by just sitting on the ground and knowing that is a big relief. Cause a lot of people I've talked to, like, oh, I thought that sitting on the ground was bad for your back. I'm like, bad for your back? I'm like, it's the greatest thing you could do for your back. Now I've got to guide you back, because, well, you've spent 4 decades sitting in a chair.
Yep.
I can't just peel the bandages off right now and throw you into it. Your nervous system wouldn't be ready. It's like cold turkey. You just don't want to do that.
Right.
So there's ways to do this. And that's kind of what we're trying to do, is educate people and then show them where they are, show them where they're going to go, help them understand that 90%, which is the lifestyle. The 10% is the training. They're both GOTA. We want them to stay GOTA, but just kind of help guide them. And that's where we start. We start with an assessment. We want them to get in front of a coach and let a coach take a look at you in slow motion, and then show you in slow motion so that you can identify. Because like I said earlier, that was what made everything make sense to me. That's what created the buy-in for me, was that I know my 10 years of injuries plus, and I saw it in slow motion. I'm like, okay, this is it. I know where I'm at now. I know where I need to go.
Yeah. And I think that's important for parents, especially, you know, maybe it's obviously movement is important to us. And if we can learn something, that's great. But I think for our kids coming up that are into sports, and even if they're not into sports, but there's this opportunity for scholarships and something like that. And you don't want to see an injury.
Nope.
Especially like in their senior year or junior year when they're starting to turn heads, something that could have been avoided, and then it's just thrown away, you know, or they have that injury and maybe they don't go to the school they were supposed to go to because they're kind of leery of, well, what if they re-injure?
It happens all the time.
Yep.
It happens all. And like I said, I've said to people, like, look, we're at a position right now where my dad's generation, they went through it. They're wrecked. Like it's documented. They're wrecked. So I'm sitting here and I'm saying, okay, do I do the exact same thing and then be 50 years old and say, oh man, I should have known? No, like right now is the moment to turn around and tell the younger kids, hey, don't do this because this is what this will lead to. Gilly's older than me. My dad's older than me, obviously, but they know more people that have trained in this style of lifting derivatives, as we call it. They're all wrecked. They all need new hips. They all need new knees. Their backs are hurting. Mm-hmm. They would gladly pay a large sum of money to have all of it back to when they were 15, 16 and those gyroscopes were healthy.
Yeah.
So we're sort of, I feel the responsibility as a former player who was injured and now took the time to figure out what was right and learn from Gilly and kind of match it up. Like, oh, this is it. I need to turn around and tell the young kids, hey guys, don't do this and this, because it's not what you are designed as a human to be doing. So a lot of it's the education and just getting that info back to the parents and the kids. And that's really who we're after. We're after the athlete and I'm after the parent. I want them to understand this, because The point of the recode is to not have to recode.
Right.
I don't want you to be dependent on me. I want you to learn from me and then go ahead and take that and help your family and friends and take ownership in it. Because that's how it would have to be to be able to go a full lifespan and not get one of your gyroscopes replaced because of a bad movement pattern.
Yeah. And there, I mean, there's really something to be said with the names of the athletes that you named.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like Bruce Willis in Unbreakable. Yes. I mean, there's got to be a reason these guys are never injured. If they are, you know, maybe it's some freak thing. But So the last thing I want to follow up with is, you know, you're a father now. Mm-hmm. Me and Mike are both fathers. What kind of piece of advice would you give as a dad to a kid that's looking to dream big? And I think as a kid, you don't quite understand the dedication and hardship you have to put through. I don't think that realization is there. Maybe for the parent, maybe not even for the parent. Yeah. But what kind of advice would you have if there was a dad listening that you see something great in your kid and you just want to help them get to that next level?
You know my father, and you know how I learned everything through him. He's my role model. He's my hero. And the greatest thing about my dad for us in that situation of, you know, dealing with sports as a father and a son and trying to tackle this goal of, you know, wanting to play Division I sports, wanting to play professional sports. I think that's where you start. Does the kid have that goal? Do they want that? Mm-hmm. Because that's where it starts. If the kid doesn't want it, there's really not much that the parent can do. But when the kid shows that they want this, that we'll go after it, I think the father or the mother in that situation, there's this fine line of really the playing around this honesty. Like, my dad was always there to give me honest feedback. It may not have been what I wanted to hear, but it was honest feedback. So even in those moments where I was getting constructive criticism, there was always this 40,000 foot view of my dad saying, you can do whatever you want. You can be whoever you want. You know, you could, why not you? He would always say that. Why not you? Why can't you be that guy? Why can't you go play in Division I football? Why not? So there was always this, like, believe in yourself, but also, hey, you need to work on the errors so that you can go do what you want to do. So I think there's finding that blend as a parent where you're encouraging, you're giving them the positive, you know, mindset that they need, because they need that. But at the same time, you've got to get them better. You've got to be that constructive criticism. You can't be their friend. You got to be their coach in a sense as a parent. I think it's finding that fine line with your son or your daughter to where the goal is there. The athlete wants to do this. And then you're encouraging that big brain, that big excitement that you have as a kid where you're like, I can do all these great things. You need to encourage that as a parent. But at the same time, we have to be real that, you know, we've got things we got to work on. And I think if you as a parent are just, you're great. If you're never taking any ownership as an athlete, that's a big thing that I see with young kids where the parent wants to bail them out from the adverse situation, because you don't want to see your kids go through adverse situations.
Yeah.
You don't want to see your kid deal with blame and with hardships. But the reality is, the best thing my dad ever did was make me take ownership of everything. Even if it feels comfortable or is possible to point a finger, we don't do it. We just don't do it in this house. You take complete ownership of your stuff all the time. It's sort of the saying that I got from my strength coach at Iowa, Coach Doyle, was you have to look in the mirror. You've got to be the leader that looks in the mirror. Every time something goes wrong, or you look right in the mirror. Something goes bad, you look in the mirror and you fix it on your end. You can't look out the window. So a lot of people will look out the window when something goes bad and they're looking for somebody to blame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so my dad was big on that as a young kid. Like, we don't blame anybody but ourselves. So that, coupled with me wanting to, and then my dad constantly pushing me, like, dude, you can do it. I'm like, even those days where, like I told you, I don't think I'm ever going to play D1 football. My dad knew when to pull off the gas pedal a little bit, let him work through this. And then when it was boom, push the gas pedal again. Mm-hmm. And so my dad was very good at kind of understanding that, you know, you're going to go through these ebbs and flows as an athlete, especially as a young kid. I mean, goodness gracious, high school is tough enough to kind of work your way through it at times. So, you know, does the kid want it? And then give them that feedback, give them the constructive criticism, but always, you know, it's everything that you want in a great coach. They're going to yell at you, but they're going to hug you too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to have both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Would you ever consider coaching?
I consider myself a coach and a teacher right now with what I do at GOTA. Yeah. And it's like the perfect amount of like me being able to give the constructive criticism and to be there for other people and to help them through their tough times with movement specifically or throughout their sport in any way that I can. But then I also don't have to be in a situation where if I'm a, you know, I saw it firsthand, college coaches, pro coaches, it's a huge time demand. And I just, where the age that my kids are at, you know, 6, 4, and 2, I just, it's really not my passion. I love football. I still love football. I'm a big fan of the game. But I've kind of transitioned to more of a 40,000 foot view. I want to help all athletes. You know, I'm so excited and amped up about human movement that I hate to restrict myself to just quarterback.
Right.
Because there's so many different athletes that I could help. Not even athletes, just people that are, like you said, general population. You know, I have, there's people that I know that they want to be a referee. Well, that includes running. Absolutely. So like something like that. And so those types of things, people have goals and I want to help people reach those goals and use my experience to kind of help them understand that, hey, you can come from a place where your body's a little wrecked and you can recode that. So where I'm at right now is perfect because I get to coach and I get to teach, but I get to do it in multiple different, you know, facets and in areas of sport. And it doesn't, you know, require me to be away from my kids for a long period of time. So I'm really enjoying it right now.
That's awesome. Yeah, Ricky, we appreciate you coming on the show. Yeah. It's been awesome having you. We're glad you've found success after your NFL career. It's been a pleasure from my side as well as my side.
Same. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's a lot of fun.
And with that, we get to the part of the show we call the wrap-up.
Wrap it up.
We want to thank Ricky Stanzi for being on the show today. The contest rules for the autographed jersey will be on all our social media pages. You know, whether you want it for your man cave, to wrap it up and re-gift it, or make a quick buck off eBay.
Whatever you guys decide to do. We hope you win.
So we appreciate you guys tuning in. This has been the Vulgar Burrito Podcast. I'm Dave.
I'm Mike.
We'll catch you guys next episode.
Peace
out.